birthday party?
Miracle. There you go.
Welcome to the Abracadam Podcast. I'm your host, stand-up comedy magician Danny Whitson. Like always, abracadamits, I hope you're getting stuff done, son. Setting those goals, making things happen. It's been a good week here at the Whitson Castle. I've stayed on track. You know, I've started my exercise habits. I'm trying to keep that going. So far, so good. And whatever it is you're working on, man, I'm rooting for you. So I hope you stay focused and get things done. Speaking about staying focused, let's talk about TikTok real quick, man. I don't know, man. It's like I got a love hate with TikTok because there's a lot of things about TikTok I do not like. I think there's a lot of unoriginal stuff and a lot of crap on there. A lot of people selling their souls for views and likes and whatever. Kind of gross. But at the same time, I can't stop watching it. No, it's weird. You know, I catch myself watching TikTok videos and I send all the videos to my buddies. Like, oh, you got to see this one. Yeah. You know, and I can't stop it. It's weird. Like, have you ever been watching like TikTok and all of a sudden you next thing you know, you're like, what year is it? You know what I mean? That's how far you can just get and go. That's why it's called TikTok. Yeah. It takes up all your time watching middle-aged people dance, you know, to Rob Bass. Anyways, let's give a shout-out to some upcoming show dates we got happening. February 1st, I'm going to be at Stand Up Live in Huntsville, Alabama with the very funny Shelly Belly. Please go to standuplive.com if you're in Huntsville and get some tickets because they are going quick and that is going to be a good show. February 2nd, I think I said February 1st was Stand Up Live, I'm sorry. And February 2nd, I'm going to be at the Stardome Comedy Club in Birmingham, Alabama. Same thing, go to stardomecomedy.com, get those tickets. They're going fast. And then February 3rd, I'm going to wrap things up. I'm going to be at Zany's Comedy Club in Nashville, Tennessee. Once again, get them tickets if you're in Nashville. We are going to have a abracadam good time, baby. All right. So let's get things going. Let's give a big shout out to the sponsor for the Abracadam Podcast. Okay. Well, today's episode is brought to you by Rosie Tattoos. Custom tattoos designed to suit your style in a friendly and clean environment. I've been getting my tattoos done by Rosie for a while now, and I couldn't recommend anyone else because she does excellent work. As a matter of fact, I got an appointment to see Rosie here in just a few weeks, and I cannot wait to get my ink therapy done, baby. Rosie gets free consultations by Facebook Messenger, Instagram, or by email. Shoot her an email at rosietattoos@yahoo.com. Give Rosie a call today at 865-281-3451 or go see Rosie at 5710 Kingston Pike, Knoxville, Tennessee. Get your ink therapy done. You know you want a tattoo. Go see Rosie Tattoos. Okay, abracadamits. Now, today's guest, oh my gosh. Okay, I got to say, man. Out of all the guests that I have had on here, this one makes my top five. Okay, I do have a top five, and this guy is in the top five. He has the stories that he tells. Literally, I feel like a little kid gathering up around the campfire, getting ready to hear some awesome stories, and that's exactly what I heard. He is an actor, and he has literally been in every single movie almost you could think about from the 1990s. His resume isn't impressive. It is intimidating, literally. He has been in White Men Can't Jump, Conspiracy Theory, Slam Dunk Ernest, for God's sakes, working with Jim Varney. He has done some super cool stuff. So many movies, literally so many more movies. Blue Chips, gosh, you name it. He has been done everything. And right now, currently, he's working on a documentary called Inherit the Land, a really awesome story, American history, true story that'll be out soon that you definitely have to check out. He's even got his own whiskey. Yes. So if you will, abracadamits, sit back and relax and enjoy my fun conversation with the very talented actor Silk Kozart.
All right, I'm excited today. We got Silk Cozart here on the Abracadam podcast. How you doing, Silk?
I'm fine now. I'm good. Good to see you. Thank you for having me on.
Well, first of all, you know, to say that this is exciting is an understatement. And people in the acting world know who you are. Movie buffs know who you are. But if you don't mind, will you go ahead and introduce yourself to the Abracadam listeners?
Sure. First of all, how y'all doing? It's good to be here. My name is Silk Cozart. It's with a C. It's one of those odd Cherokee nicknames. It's C-Y-L-K. And I made some movies like, I guess, White Men Can't Jump. They probably hadn't seen any of my films. Conspiracy Theory with Julia Roberts. Also Mel Gibson. Eraser. Some School Days, Spike Lee. I mean, Three to Tango with the lovely Neve Campbell and crazy Matthew Perry. 16 Blocks with the wonderful Bruce Willis. I mean, just a few films that Eraser with Vanessa Williams. And how can you forget Arnold Schwarzenegger?
That is, I mean, your resume is beyond insane. It's super impressive. And I mean, it's intimidating. You. When you look at your resume, oh, no. You're like, Silk has worked with the who's who, you know?
And hey.
Well, I'll tell you what, one thing right off the bat, okay, because there's so many movies we can talk about. And, you know, let's talk about this one first. And then I want to get into kind of how you got into acting. And, you know, also, let's not forget, Silk, you're also an athlete, brother. You're a basketball player. So, let's talk about a movie first, right off the bat, that had an impact on my childhood. Because the day after watching this movie, okay, I was at Robertsville Junior High, and we were doing the My Mama jokes from White Men Can't Jump on each other. So please tell us about what it was like on White Men Can't Jump.
Well, first of all, the great Woody Harrelson just made that movie so special. And of course, Wesley Snipes, a great actor, Rosie Perez, but Ron Shelton, the writer director who wrote and directed Bull Durham and a bunch of other movies he's a great filmmaker, first of all. And we just finished that film right when the Rodney King riots started. So we had this beautiful movie in the can, ready to go. And then all of a sudden, the whole LA and Hollywood is on lockdown for weeks and weeks. So it was crazy. So, wow. You know, so anyway, it became, you know, what it was. I was in Africa after the movie came out, and a pilot came up to me and says, "Oh, what's been dog's jump?" And I went, you know me. He goes, "Oh, go back to SeaWorld." And it showed me how large that the outreach of that film. And of course, TV, you know, Fresh Prince of Bel Air did and Saved by the Bell, and that millions of people saw that. So they wasn't sure if I'm the same person in White Men Can't Jump as in Conspiracy Theory. So it's been a nice run. Let's just say that.
Gosh, I couldn't imagine. Now, so, okay, well, I had to mention that up front. I had to, because, I mean, that's just that's a classic, man. And, you know, my generation especially, we watched White Men Can't Jump. And, you know, matter of fact, I'll be honest. I've actually got a Woody Harrelson shirt from White Men Can't Jump. You know, remember, really? Remember the old classic back in the 80s? They always had the Showtime, the classic basketball player shirts. You had Magic, yes. and Jordan. You know, it was those old. Well, they have one of Woody Harrelson from White Men Can't Jump. unfortunately, since COVID, I've gained so much weight I can't even fit in it no more. But anyway, I should have wore that. Gosh. But anyways, let's do this real quick, Silk. Let's back up to whenever you was a little Silk, and how did this happen, man? Where did it start?
Well, you know, I'm just like any other kid growing up in America. Except in Tennessee, the very, very hardcore South in the 60s. I was a kid. I came up during, I was a baby. Martin Luther King was killed. And so I was what they call bused to an all-white school when I was in the second grade. So from the third on, I was like the only piece of whole wheat toast in the whole loaf. And it was tough. But so sports was a way of, you know, getting out. So I got to play basketball and football, and I started, you know, tried to do plays. But it started right there, because you know, there's not much to do when you're in the woods, you become like the animals. So I made up stuff. And then church, I went to church and, you know, you got to be in the choir and all that. And like my first play got me interested. And the first play, I was one of the three wise men. And I forgot my line. I think I was supposed to bring frankincense. And I said, Frank sent me, you know, something crazy. I mean, it was crazy. But everybody laughed. And that feeling that you get when the audience throws it back at you, you're like, you don't forget that. And you crave that the rest of your life. So the only place I could find that was either on the basketball court or acting. And so when, by the time the first film came along in Miami, I felt like I'd already been doing it. So it wasn't really unfamiliar to me.
Now, first of all, it probably helped your situation for being, you know, a minority that you would, I mean, because there's a lot of people who do sports, don't move over into plays. Don't do
that. That's true.
You know, you know, like I love it. You know, my son, he graduated from Oak Ridge High School. And
right.
He was in The Music Man and he killed it. You know,
I love it.
This kid, I mean, you know, now he lives out in Vegas.
Shout out to your son, man. Way to go.
He killed it. But I wanted to look at the performing arts. And I was like, you know, it would be nice if the performing arts got as much attention as sports, you know, because there's a lot of, I imagine the talent that we could have in films if it was kind of more open. Like, you know, you being a sports person transitioning to acting, that's rare, but thank God you did.
Well, it's amazing you say that because I've always wanted to develop a program once I went through Hollywood, because for students, middle school, high school, and college, because everybody learns differently. Some people have to move around to think, and theater and drama gets you up out of your seat and, you know, you get to play a character. And what if you played a character in middle 1800s? You play Lincoln. I play, you know, the constable that went after, you know, the killer. I mean, and then we read those chapters. And then when we put it up on the stage, we remember almost every single word. And then that's just, everybody is different. So I always thought, man, the arts help the other subjects so well because it gives you confidence. And like sports, playing on a team, it's a team thing. You learn that somebody has a better idea than you sometimes.
You know, and that's one thing I do love about sports, because sports teaches a lot about teamwork and teaches you how to work together. But the one thing I'll say about performing arts is it does build a sense of confidence in you. I mean, not an arrogance, but confidence that you're willing.
Right. Big difference.
Exactly. Big difference. But that's how, you know, you started out and you got into play. You kind of caught the bug. You caught the acting bug. Now, you said your first film in Miami.
Blue Skies Again with Andy Garcia.
Wow. Gosh.
Yeah.
Man.
Yeah. Yeah. It was about the first female to try out for a professional baseball team. And it's a true story. Based on a true story.
Wow.
Harry Hamlin, Mimi Rogers, Dana Elkar, Kenneth McMillan. Great, great cast. You know, I could play baseball, but I wasn't a baseball player. Let's just say. So the tryouts were at Fort Lauderdale Stadium where the New York Yankees train. And they had all these pro players throwing the ball, hitting the ball, catching the ball, you know, doing the tricks. And I'm thinking, what am I doing here? I'm a basketball player. I can do that, but I can't do it. I could throw it really hard and I could hit when I connected. But, you know, it was the first thing. So I wanted to show how I could throw. Well, I threw very hard and the Yankees guy was clocking me and it was pretty high for somebody that they didn't know. So they put me down to be one of the pitchers. And so they needed athletes that could act and they needed actors that could play ball. And Andy Garcia, nobody knew who he was. I didn't know. We ended up being roommates. And
really?
He was like, I'm from Cuba, you know? And I was like, well, I'm from Knoxville. So what? We became friends. And the next thing you know, you're trying out. And when it came time to hit, I was like batting like this. You know, I said, I don't want to hit. I just throw. And it ended up being a Warner Brothers. I got to meet with Warner Brothers first time with the studio. So you learn the difference in a studio than an independent film. So it taught me a lot.
How old were you there, Silkwood?
Let's see. I think I was 23, right out of college.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that.
Yeah, I just tried out with the Denver Nuggets.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice. So.
Got hurt.
Well, that must have been a surreal moment, though, still, to still get that opportunity to do stuff like that. You know.
Absolutely. I was out there during the time they were doing Miami Vice. I know you probably don't remember that.
Oh, I do. But I do.
But you know, everything was like, you know, jackets, you know, dinner jackets with T-shirts with no socks, you know.
You know what I used to do? Like, I used to do this in the 80s. In the 80s, Silk, I used to do this because me and my dad would watch Miami Vice. You know, I would watch it with my dad, one of those things. And I remember in the 80s, I would always slick my hair back and pretend to be Don Johnson.
I did that too. I tried that.
Man, that is awesome. So, but
I tried to get a teal jacket. Never could find a teal jacket.
Don Johnson, he's back. He's in something now, right? He's working again.
He's so talented. He is so talented.
So that was like the starting point, and then you know, What year was that film, by the way? Do you remember?
85.
85. So that's when you broke into the game, is in the 80s.
Yeah. Well, I was trying everything. I was kickboxing, training with some crazy guys in Miami for like a year and a half before. And then I said, I just want to be in a movie. I just want to be an extra. So I got in this like Tarzan movie, but I don't look African, right? I'm Cherokee and black, but ain't nothing African. You don't look at me and go, oh, you know, he's from Zimbabwe. You know,
yeah.
They look at me and they don't know where I'm from. They go, what? We don't get the hair. We don't get, you know, we don't know. You sound like you're some country bumpkin, you know. And anyway, so I get out there and I say, well, I'll be an extra. I don't care. I knew I wasn't going to be an extra for my whole life, you know.
Yeah.
But I just wanted to learn. And that's why I did that. I did a bunch, everything. I didn't care if I even got paid. I wanted to be on the set, know where to stand, where to sit. Where to stay out of the way, you know, how to stay out of the way and learn how different actors, you know, prepare, you know. And I learned so much that first film with Harry Hamlin. He's a great actor. Mimi Rogers. It was just great.
Wow.
A guy named Joey Gian. But Andy Garcia was great then, you know.
Wow. That is, I mean, and this is, you know, I'm a firm believer in making things happen for yourself.
Yes. You know, put yourself in the arena where you want to play.
Amen. That's right. Exactly. So, and that sounds like exactly kind of what you did. Now, I think it was in 88. Was it 88 you did a Spike Lee movie?
Yes. School Days.
Now,
Dr. Feel Good.
So what was that? What was Spike Lee like?
Let me tell you, Spike is a tough guy to get to know. One day he's like, hey, let's go. What are we going to eat after the set? And then the next day you show up, you go, hey man, that was a good time last night. He goes, you're like, hey, Spike over here. And he's like, so you never knew which Spike was going to show up, but he was good to me. And, gave me an opportunity to play with some unbelievable actors. Like it was Larry Fishburne then. Now it's Lawrence, you know,
you knew him when he was Larry. Oh.
Yeah. And, you know, look at, golly, it was just the fact, Tisha Campbell, you know, Jasmine Guy, Kadeem Hardison. I mean, you got all those people like that. And, you know, Sam Jackson, that was the first time I'd ever seen Sam. He played the guy in the Kentucky Fried Chicken with the shower cap.
I didn't know he was in the movie.
Oh, yeah, I was like, who's that guy? He's scary. He goes, hey, Sam, that's Sam. You know.
Okay, well, let me ask you this, because one you know, unique thing about Samuel Jackson is he's from Chattanooga, correct?
Tennessee boy.
Tennessee, that's right. So did you ever talk about being from both Tennessee or?
We did, but we started to talk about working together, and he's working every day. You know, I work every other year maybe, you know? But we would pass each other and we just never worked together. We still got time, as we say this every time we see each other. All right, we're gonna do something, damn it. We're gonna find something to do. you know.
That has to happen. We have to see a movie.
I'm going to just write something for him and beg him to play him, you know. Like they did with Julia Roberts, Dick Donner, God bless him. I know we're not at that point, but when you talk about a great director and a great human being, he set it up to where Julia was like the biggest star in the world at that point. And I think it was around 97, 96, 97. And Mel Gibson, it was, they had somebody before Julia, and Mel said, we're friends. I can't kiss her. You know? Oh, yeah. And it was Jodie Foster. And they've been friends. He goes, I can't, no. And so he said, well, who do you want? He said, what about Julia Roberts? He said, can't afford Julia Roberts. She's $20 million a movie. Well, Mel was getting $20 million a movie. But Dick Donner set up a band, a marching band, to march outside, to be ready outside her apartment in New York, blocked off the street. You know what it takes to block off a street in New York City? Anyway, it was right outside of her hotel room or her apartment. And so Mel and Dick went up to her apartment, knocked on the door. She opens the door. She goes, guys, what are you doing? She says, please take the role. Please do it. Please play it. And then she's like, well, it was roses. They gave her flowers every day. And she was like, well, okay. And they were like, yeah, okay. Let's go over to the window, open the window. And then they go, I love you, baby. You know, the song in the whole movie. So it was just, the band played that song, which was the song throughout the whole film. I mean, the whole story with that was just phenomenal. I don't know if the fans think that's interesting, but I was
absolutely
like,
absolutely, it is. Absolutely. Wow. That's awesome. Well, let's talk about the movie. Let's talk about Conspiracy Theory. And first of all, I remember the movie, and it was a great movie. It was an awesome movie. I think if they made it today, it would be a different kind of movie, though.
Yeah, I think you're right. And you know, a lot of people don't know how that movie was really funded.
Really?
I got to meet somebody during that time, a person by the name of Jody Faye. And he was dating our princess.
Really?
They were at Warner Brothers, and I got to meet them. And it was surreal because she hugged me and brought me in, gave me a kiss. I was like, thank you, Princess Diana. She goes, call me Diana. I was like, I can't call you Diana. I didn't say that, but in my mind, you know, the bodyguard was sitting there. I was like, yes, ma'am. Yes, Diana. I just couldn't do it. She was the nicest, sweetest thing in the world.
Wow.
And anyway, so they were a big part of the funding for Conspiracy Theory.
Wow. Princess Di.
Yep.
Wow. Yep.
That's kind of a crazy story right there. I have never told many people that. I mean, some of my boys know that, you know, but that was because I said, man, she kissed me right here. I was like, golly. So it really hurt me when she left this place. I was like,
oh yeah.
She was so kind. She was so normal. She's so normal.
Well, she did a lot of good things too.
Yeah. But anyway, but Dick Donner was an unbelievable man. Do you know, we were in New York for about 2.5 months. We were in LA for about 2.5 months, Toronto for about 3 months. I mean, it was about a 7-month shoot. And that was a long shoot. That's like a year on a set. So you get to know people, you know? Wow. So I'm a rookie, right? Compared, you know, I'm Mel Gibson, Julia Roberts, you know, all these guys. And I'm sitting there in my gigantic mobile, you know, just a little, it was just a little place to hang out, little dressing room. They gave me a gigantic mobile house. So I was like, I like this, you know? So I'm sitting there real early in the morning, and Mel Gibson knocks on my door, and he goes, what are you doing? I was like, just thinking about the scene, you know? I said, why, you want to go over? He goes, no, I don't even know what we're doing. I said, what? Anyway, he says, and he had a box with it, and it had a big ribbon around. He goes, look, I got something for our leading lady. It's like a tradition. I was like, oh no, I didn't get any. I don't have any. He goes, don't worry. Don't worry about it. It's just, you know, it's from both of us. I was like, how cool is this guy? You know? So we go, right next to me is her dressing room trailer. She comes out, curlers, you know, everything. She goes, guys, what are you doing? And she says, all right, come in. So we go in. Mel goes, well, this is something from the guys, me and Silk, we thought we'd, you know, put something together for you. And I'm like going, wow, how cool is that, you know? And she opens the first box, and it's another box and another box. And like she gets to the last box, and she opens it and throws it up, and she screams, and it's a freeze-dried rat. That's Mel. Mel Gibson's crazy, his tricks. She screamed, and I went back. I almost went out the door, and Mel was just horse laughing. He was like, And Julia hated me from that. And I said, I didn't know. She goes, yeah, right, sir. I said, Julia, I didn't know. She goes, I don't believe you. It took a week to get her love back. And then she had to hit me on the head for a scene. And I told her, I said, you got me back, because she really hit me. And I was out for a little bit one time. And she goes, I swear I didn't mean that. I was like, yeah, right.
Well, first of all, I love a good prank. You know, that's what I do. But I don't know if I would have done the freeze-dried rat that to Julia Roberts.
Freeze-dried rat.
That was a weird one.
Yeah. Well, he tried to put a roach in my mashed potatoes one day.
A real roach.
Well, I didn't see it move, but it looked real to me.
Man. Okay, well, let me do this all right. I'm telling you, Silk, man, so much stuff. You've done so much stuff. Like I said, it's mind-blowing. Just for, okay, whenever it's, you know, you're in the moment, okay? You're sharing a room next door to Julia Roberts, you know, a trailer and stuff like that. And Mel Gibson, exactly. And Mel Gibson is knocking on your door.
Yeah.
Was there ever, Princess Di kissed you. Is there ever a moment that you just, did you sit down in your life?
Tyra Banks, Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. Got to kiss her. So
you got to kiss Tyra Banks.
And Fresh Prince. But I know where you're going. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
But I mean, did you ever just sit down and it's like, man, what, you know, I'm from Knoxville. What in the world is going on? How is this possible?
You know what? Every time it started to go there, a calmness would come over me and go, you know what? Obviously you're supposed to be here. You know, they're treating me just like I've been there for years. I can't tell you how comfortable that Woody Harrelson and Dick and all the people. I mean, I can't tell you how cool these people are and nice. And they're the most talented people on the planet. I was blown away that I wasn't intimidated. I never, not once, have I felt intimidated. Only time I felt really like nervous, as far as, you know, God, I don't know how this is gonna go, is that when I wasn't quite prepared for a scene. That I was prepared, but I wasn't prepared as I wasn't as where I wanted to be. And I started second guessing myself, and I would forget lines and stuff. And that scared me, because I'm like, they're gonna replace me in a minute, you know? But I got a really quick story when I did Firebirds with Nicolas Cage.
I know, I saw that, by the way. I was looking at your IMDb, and then I saw Firebirds, and I remembered that movie back in the day. I was like, I loved that movie.
Tommy Lee Jones.
Yes.
Tommy Lee Jones. Let me tell you how intimidating that man is. We were on the set for, you know, in Arizona, you know, in Killeen, Texas. We were on an army base filming. So he was walking around hardcore, never smiled. He'd look at you, go, like, what you looking at? I mean, he never said hello. I mean, not even after we're finished filming. So I just thought he hated me, right? But he did that to everybody. So about 2 weeks into filming, we're doing a scene where, you know, he's the guy. He's the one teaching us how to fly the new Apache, which got Noriega, by the way. That was the first. Yeah. Anyway, so that was during that time in 89, 90, 91, that time. So we're on the set filming right before lunch. The director's down on the first floor shooting to the second floor. So Tommy Lee and I are facing each other, and we're just supposed to cross. That's all we're supposed to do is cross, and we're going to lunch. You know, I salute him, and we go on. Well, we get right here almost next to each other, and there's a pole right here. For whatever reason, he would stop or make a move where I would have to adjust, or I would have ran into the pole. And I'm thinking, I ain't running into the damn pole. He ain't gonna run. Is he trying to run me into the pole? And I'm thinking, cut. And you hear cut, and the director, you know, he goes, Silk, I need you to just go straight through. Don't stop. I said, okay. You know, I'm thinking I'll adjust and I'll just take two, action. We get there and I'm like, shit, he's going to knock me into the pole, you know. And cut, Silk, what are you doing? I said, I got it. I was just going to leave a beat earlier or a beat late. And I thought, I'm good, right? Action, get there. He does the same thing. It's like he did it on purpose. And I said, he's messing with me. He goes, and the director says, cut. Okay, so I said, I got it. I'm sorry, it's my fault. Well, this is the fourth take. And we're going to lunch. Everybody's ready to go. It's 30 people down there in the crew. It's crazy. Action. We get there. He does his thing. And I go, bam. I hit him so hard with my right shoulder. And there's a ledge. There's a rail. He went, like, grabbed the rail. God, what is going on? And then I said, hey, I'm sorry, but I wasn't going to run it to the pole. And Tommy Lee Jones, he backs up. He looks at me like, well, I need some room. I need some damn room. And I was like, you got all the room you want. You tried to run me into, I mean, I'm arguing with Tommy Lee Jones. He's, you know, he's winning an Oscar. And I'm sitting there, who the hell am I? And I'm thinking, and it hit me that I'm going to be on the plane going back to Hollywood in about 2 hours. You know, nobody said anything. The director said, okay, let's break for lunch and we'll talk about this. Nobody said anything. It was quiet. And Tommy looked like he was ready to fight me. I was like, oh, God, that's going to be a hell of a, you know, I don't know about this one. You know, I was like, I'm preparing. So I'm thinking he's going to hit me, right? I really thought he's going to come up and hit me. So I go to lunch at the lunch wagon. I get my lunch and I feel something on my back and I turn and it's Tommy. He goes, what's your name? I said, Silk. He goes, Silk, what kind of name's that? I said, it's a Cherokee name. It's like a nickname, means running water thing. He goes, Cherokee, hell, we might be related. He said, where are you eating at? Next thing you know, we're like, it was cool. And I never asked him, why did you, you know, I said, man, I'm going to see him one day. I've never seen him since then. One of these days, I'm going to see him. I'm going to go, what? I know you remember this, you know. Anyway, unbelievable, man, crazy story.
That is awesome. That is so, you know, okay. Well, let me bring this back. I got to bring this up. Okay. This is a funny thing because, all right, Silk, now we all know you have kissed some famous people. All right. You have mentioned it, but there's one kiss that you're not mentioning on here, brother. Probably the most famous kiss in your career. You kissed Woody Harrelson on the cheek, bro.
You know what? And that was my idea. And I didn't tell anybody. We were done filming that scene and we were, and the cameras were getting ready to break to go to the next scene. And we're in Watts, right? We had to get a gang truce just to shoot in Watts. Right. Cause remember, that was right around that crazy time. So I felt like everything was mechanical with me. I said, we had been rehearsing certain, you know, plays and stuff. And I just said, I went to Ron Shelton. I said, I go to the director. I can't believe I did this, but now we're friends. I just can't believe I said, Ron, I need one more take. He's like, they're moving the cameras around. He goes, you know, I didn't know it costs like 50 grand every time you do a take, you know. And he goes, oh, really? I said, yeah. I said, that felt phony. He goes, oh, really? Now he wrote it. I'm thinking, oh, shit. He's gonna kill me, you know. But I didn't think about it then. And he says, okay, all right, I don't want to hear what you're going to do. I just want you to just do it. I said, okay. I had no idea what I was going to do because I went to the cameraman, Chuck Cohen, who's a friend of mine today. I said, Chuck, just follow me. He can't guard me anyway. I said, the scene is supposed to be he can't guard me, and we score, and I score, right? He goes, yeah. I said, well, just follow me. He goes, what are you going to do? I said, I don't know. And he goes, and Ron said, I don't want to hear it. Just do it. And Woody was going, what's going on, you know? And so we did the scene, and that whole scene, when I'm dribbling, I'm talking, I'm telling, that was all made up right there. And Wesley went with it, and Woody went with it. And I did not plan this, but you know how in the mafia, they kiss the guy when you kill him, when you know he's going to die? You know, he's like, wow, you know, Ribeiro, you know? Yeah, I thought of that. I was like, wow, You know, what he went with, he's so good. He went with it, man, you know, and it awesome. Became, and that's the scene they use. And go back to SeaWorld wasn't written. I just said that. And it became what they used in advertising all over the world. And you never know what's going to happen. So those young actors out there, I know there's not many watching this show, but it doesn't matter, actor or what, don't be afraid to express yourself. Just know when to express it. You don't yell it out. You go to the director or the person in charge, take them off to the side and go, hey, I got an idea. When could I talk to you about it? Or can I do it? You know, I didn't know to do that, but now it's great to do that.
Mind blown now, because that was basically, you just came up with that and then you did it. And yeah, that makes the scene. That's the scene right there. That was one of the most cold hearted thing you could do. And that was okay. Well, let me ask you this.
Okay.
Who is Woody and Wesley? Are they ballers? Were they really ballers?
Woody's a pretty good ball player. Wesley's an incredible athlete.
Oh, yeah. Now, we know Wesley can kick some ass. We know that.
Yeah, he's a bad boy. He capoeira. That's that Brazilian martial arts that's real sweeps and low stances. And he's a dancer. You know, and it's from a Brazilian dance, capoeira. But he is just so good. And he's not a basketball player. You can see that he's not like, you know, he's not like smooth and stuff. He's like, you know, and so I worked with him just on little things, the release and all this stuff. After, you know, and it was supposed to be me and Woody, but the studio wouldn't allow me because nobody knew who I was. And that's they Ron Shelton rewrote the script.
Wow.
To put me in that character. That wasn't a character. The security guard was not even, it was a character, but it didn't have maybe one line. But so Ron wrote the other scenes around that.
Wow.
So anyway, that movie changed my life. Ron Shelton is the reason that I'm still in this business.
Man, this is awesome. So cool, dude. Okay. Well, let me ask you this, cause you've done a lot of sports type movies, especially basketball. There's one guy I've got to ask you about that is near dear to, I think, a lot of people in Tennessee in the 90s and 80s and 90s. You worked with Jim Varney, correct?
Oh, slam dunk artist. We shot that in Vancouver, and I had never been to Canada. And they had an actor to play the second lead after him, but he shaved his head the day of rehearsal, and he got fired.
Why? Why would you do that?
He shaved his head. For whatever reason. That's what my agent said. He said, look, I was supposed to play OJ in the OJ had just, you know, that trial. And yeah. I was supposed to be OJ. Fox had called and we were negotiating. Vince Cerincione was my manager. He had Halle Berry. It was a big deal. And then I was on my knees every day. I called my mom. I said, Mom, I don't know what to do here. They want me to play OJ in this thing. And it's called White Bronco. And they only have 12 pages. There's no script. And, you know, And she goes, you just say a prayer and you'll know what to do. You know, I was like, thanks, Mom, I did that. You know, but finally, I turned it down. And, you know, after the divorce, yeah, everything, I just turned it down. I couldn't do it because it felt weird to me. And Entertainment Tonight did a whole story and stuff. They came to the house. I was like, I just, you know, I'm not doing it.
Yeah.
Next thing I know, I get a call and they say, yeah, an actor fell out in Vancouver. It's a Disney thing, a Jim Varney movie. I said, like, Jim Varney? I said, I'll carry water on the set. I said, I love him. And they said, well, I said, can I audition? And they went, no, they want you to replace the actress, the second lead in the movie. I said, really? I said, I'll do it. Yes. And they said, well, you don't know what the money is for. I said, I'll pay them. I don't care. You know, so anyway, so I said, when do I start? When do they start shooting? He goes, in 2 days. And I said, where? He said, Vancouver. I was like, wow. And I hate flying, but I went, yeah, obviously. But Jim Varney was so nice. It felt like a family member. He felt like a family member. He'd collect watches. He had 100 and something different watches in these beautiful clear cases. And he kept with him. I mean, presidentials and all these different, he goes, yeah, you never know what you find on these, you know. I mean, he was so nice. And Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
Oh, I know.
Archangel of basketball. I mean, just a be on the set with these guys was phenomenal.
What was Kareem like? I mean,
Was like a bigger version of Spike Lee. Incredible intelligence. But he just was just kind of to himself. I know his son, you know, and knew him from playing ball a little bit, but he's just very to himself a lot, but just really, really a smart guy.
Now, okay, so let's move. I want to jump to one more sports film. Were you in Blue Chips? I believe you're in Blue Chips.
Yes.
Yeah, you're in Blue Chips too.
Now, that's where me and Shaq met.
So we got Shaq, we got Nick Nolte, Penny Hardaway. Gosh, there was so many people in that movie.
Rick Fox.
I remember that one. Yeah, yes. And when it came
Bobby
out,
Bobby Hurley.
Yes, that was. I was in high school when this movie came out. And it was a big deal because all these, you know, the who's who, that's going to be the next star athletes in this movie. So, you know, Shaq seems like he's a very fun person.
Oh, he's a big kid. Unbelievable how fun and just he still is. He hasn't changed. He hasn't changed a bit. And we shot in New Orleans and Indiana. And William Friedkin, who directed The Exorcist and The French Connection, directed this movie. He was married to Sherry Lansing, who ran Paramount.
Wow.
Ron Shelton wrote it, and he produced it. I thought he was going to direct it, but he didn't. But Billy Friedkin directed it. And we were in Indiana filming the scenes against Bobby Knight's team and everything. I mean, just being there was like, oh. So we were there, and there must have been 12 cameras in that they put in and out throughout the whole gym. And just being in that, we got to play ball with the greatest ball players in between scenes. The first time I played against Shaq, you know, I was throwing the ball up and I could dunk the ball, you know, and everybody's like, oh, Shaq can jump, right? And Shaq says, okay, yeah, bring that on in here. Bring it in here again. All right, just come on. And I was like, I'm going to get me a dunk on it, right? During the game, I tried to throw it up on the glass. I went up and the whole basket disappeared. I was like, where'd it go? It's like people don't realize how big he is and how dominating he is.
Definitely the most – I definitely probably the most strongest center ever to play the game.
Ever. Oh, ever. Will Chamberlain was very strong, but it was a different kind of strength.
Yeah.
You know, but Shaq, there's no – there. He is virtually unstoppable.
And
unless he doesn't feel like playing, you can't beat him. You're not going to win.
Well, let me ask you this. This is a sports question, Silk. Let me ask you this. All right. Now, like I said, I was a kid in the 80s, teenager in the 90s. I look at 90s NBA basketball as the greatest era of all time for me.
I can understand that.
But let's – this question is what's asked, and it's, you know, it's talked about a lot these days. Who is the GOAT? MJ or LeBron? Or let me just say, who is your GOAT? Let me just put it that way. Like, it doesn't necessarily
have one. There's only one, right? Michael. He changed the game.
Amen.
And I'm not saying LeBron didn't change his game and Jane at his time, but if you want to go on rings is one thing. If you want to go on stats, it's another. It depends. Like, I asked the great Jim Brown, who's a friend of mine. I asked him, who's the greatest? I said, who's the greatest football player in the world besides you? And he goes, why would you think I would say I'm the greatest? You know, he would ask him questions like that. I'm like, well, you are, he says. And I said, all right, the greatest running back. And then, of course, you can't just have a regular conversation with him. He goes, well, if you want to talk about speed, you might want to talk about, you know, Peyton or somebody, you know. Or you want to talk about strength, well, there's Marlon Motley. And I'm like, you're going back to the 40s. And you know, he said, so, I mean, you had to break it down with him. So with Michael, you gotta look at so many things, okay? Not just the championships, not just the team that he was on, not just the era. Because if you just look at the era, they really played defense then. You know, you didn't get by. You could hold the guy. You could do it. You could get hit. You go to the hole. You got hit. I mean,
you got beat up.
Yeah, you. I mean, look, the Celtics played. Look at Detroit.
Detroit. The
Bad Boys. You knew you were going to get hit if you drive. And you wasn't going to get a foul called either. So I just think because of that, and I met Wilt Chamberlain, I think he was unbelievable. He was a freak of nature, 7'1". He could run and help and lead the fast break. He told me he scored more than 100 points in other games that they didn't talk about. He said, they ain't going to tell you all the stuff. You know, kind of like his 30,000 women.
Yeah, exactly. You know, speaking of Wilt, me and my wife were big boxing fans. And I was just watching a thing, and I don't know if you remember this, Silk. I don't know. Of course, I don't remember this.
Where he went, tried out.
Well, didn't Wilt, weren't they at one time trying to make a dream match with Wilt Chamberlain and Ali? Yeah.
And Ali decided not to do it.
Yeah.
Because he would have hurt Wilt.
That's what I was thinking. I mean.
Yeah. He would have hurt. Wilt would have got hurt.
Yeah.
People don't understand. You get it, a great boxer knows how to hit and how not to get hit, knows how to use every ounce of their body. You're just throwing what you don't, they train every day. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's a big difference. So what do you think?
Oh no, I'm with you. I think Ali would have tucked him. Now I think Wilt Chamberlain, if he would have chose that sport, I don't know in that time era though. Maybe now, you know, because you got bigger, taller, heavyweights and stuff now. But
I'd like to see it.
Oh yeah,
I'd pay to see it.
Yeah.
Well, what about the GOAT? Back at you.
Oh, for basketball. I'm Michael, and I mean, I try to explain to people, and even as back in the day, I wasn't even a Bulls fan. I was a Lakers fan.
Same here.
I was a Lakers fan, but. I mean, people don't understand that the man was, it was like he was unhuman in those days.
Well, he also guarded the best player on the other team.
He was
the defensive player of the year twice in a row. I mean, maybe three.
He shut them down. And people also don't realize the talent that we had in the 90s, and they couldn't beat him. They could not beat him.
No.
So, I mean, Charles Barkley, that's nothing to shrug at, you know, Magic.
Great, Bird. Great Chuck.
You know, Isaiah, none of those guys are, you know, that's so.
Well, you know, they want to talk about the same thing that this world, this place we live in does to politicians. They go on their personality as opposed to what they can do. If they don't like the way Trump talks, they say he's a bad president. They don't like the way Obama sings Al Green songs and he's not a good president. I mean, it's the personality, I think, that we are attracted to. Then it's what you can do, I think.
That's true. Because, no, you're right.
You know, I mean, Michael pissed off everybody. You know, there's a lot of people don't like Michael. But,
you know,
you can't deny.
Did you see that Last Dance documentary on Netflix?
Yeah.
Man, first of all, I find it comical, okay? But first of all, I look for the comedy and stuff. That's what I do. And when I see Michael taking the janitor's money, you know.
He did it. That was him. But he also, they don't tell you where he bought a new car for him twice. It depends. It's like the Mel Gibson thing. If you catch them when they push play, record, you know, hey, in the middle of something, when they didn't see what happened right before or what you know, the girlfriend just, you know, said a lot of things, pissed him off, and then hit the record button with him responding. So, I mean, if you just see that, you think he's crazy.
You know.
Or if you just see Michael in that situation where, okay, but they didn't tell you that he took care of that guy's family for 4 years. You don't even know the whole thing. I asked Michael this one day. We had lunch in
you
Toronto.
You had lunch with Michael? Hold on, Silk. Hold on.
Yeah.
You've already dropped one on me. Now, you can't get past. You dropped the Jim Brown. You just slipped Jim Brown in on me.
Oh, that's my guy.
Now you can't do this with Michael.
Michael was supposed to play. He was supposed to be the lead in Heaven as a Playground. In 1989.
Okay.
And he wasn't Michael then, right? So me and the director asked me to go with him to sign Michael. He was on a golf course, Randall Freed. Okay. And then the movie was written by a Sports Illustrated writer. And they made Randall made a movie out of it. Okay. So it was about Bernard King's brother, Albert King, who was a phenomenal player in high school. And then, but he never really got any better. he played the same way he did in high school. He did it for the Nets. But anyway, when he did, it was about him. And Michael had just signed, you know, he was with a big agency. I think Barkley and all the guys was with him. But anyway, his agent said, well, Michael gets, you know, what's the budget on this movie? And the budget was like $2.5 or $3 million, small film. And the agent says, well, Michael gets $3 million for orange juice commercial. So he turned it down. But when me and the director went to meet Michael on the golf course to ask him to, before the offer came, that's how I met Michael. And we just remained friends ever since then. Wow. So, yeah. And anyway, it was when fast forward, he becomes Michael Jordan. I get to make movies, you know, all these years pass. We meet up. We're in Toronto. We go into his favorite Italian restaurant. We're there. And a guy comes over and he goes, he sees us. Of course, we had security. Michael had security, all, you know, different places sitting around, you know, not just on him like that. So we're enjoying the food, and this guy comes up in a suit, and he goes, oh, my God, Michael Jordan. Oh, my God. I just – look, I've always wanted to know. I just want to know what it would be like to be Michael Jordan for one day, just for one day. And Michael looks at me, and he looks back at the guy, and he goes, that's not fair. And the guy goes, what do you mean? He goes, try being Michael Jordan for a whole year. Get the downside of being Michael Jordan. He said, that ain't fair. And the guy goes, hey man, nice meeting you, dude. Yeah, I mean, you know, I looked at Michael. I was like, I never thought of that. You know, I was like,
true.
And I thought he was gonna say, man, people say that all the time. And he didn't even speak about it anymore. It was just, and then they interviewed him on his last game. He was diving on the floor, you know, stuff, getting the ball back in. And the lady interviewer says, Michael, you could have hurt yourself. This is the last game. Why would you be? He said, because it might be some 12-year-old in the audience never seen me play.
Wow.
That's Michael. That's why I love him.
Wow.
One of the reasons, you know. But yeah. Anyway, there's nobody better. I mean, who does that? I mean, it might be some 12-year-old that might has never seen me play.
That is awesome. Man, that is awesome.
So, anyway.
I tell you what, Silk. Well, let me get on. I got to ask some questions here. Man, first of all, dude, I could talk to you for hours.
Oh, man, you're great, too.
Let me ask you, what is your top five movies, your favorite personal movies? What are your top five?
Well, The Rookie is my favorite. I could see it 10 times a day, you know, with Dennis, you know, and I love Clint Eastwood, you know, just about I guess my favorite one is The Bridges of Madison County, because it involves the best actor in the world, Meryl Streep. She's here and De Niro's here, you know, and he's great. He's the greatest, right? So she's like over here. And because it's Meryl, I just like her. I can't pick a film, you know, so that's very difficult. And top five, that's so difficult. That's like saying, what do you want to eat tomorrow at 4 o'clock? You know. Oh, God. Well, White Man Can't Jump, not because I was in it, but because it changed my life.
Absolutely.
And the way it was done and all the things that had came together. And nobody knew that was going to be the biggest movie in the country. We didn't know that.
Classic.
Had no way of knowing that. And I'm a sucker for, you know, like those movies like It's a Wonderful Life. I just love those kind of movies, you know. And okay. So I guess my fifth one, I don't know if that's four or five, but one of the youngest directors to win an Academy Award, Orson Welles, in his first movie. I'm forgetting what it is now. I'll remember it in a minute.
That was, the one that everyone knows is what they talk about is War of the
Worlds. I know, everybody but us.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I know the one you're talking about, though. I do.
There's somebody out there saying, it's called.
You know what's weird is somebody had brought that movie up to me just a couple weeks ago. That's so really? Weird. And now I can't remember it. That is weird. Well, let's do this. Okay. I want to get moving here. Okay. On the Abracadam podcast, Silk Cozart, we ask every entertainer to tell a hell gig story. Let's hear it, man.
Okay. Hell gig meaning really horrible or really just funny or what?
It could be horrible. It could be funny. Just something that crazy happened to you.
Well, okay. Julie Roberts. Okay. We were making conspiracy theory. We're in New York. We're filming a scene where she finds out I'm not who I say I am. So she's supposed to knock me out. And I'm telling her she didn't want to do it. She says, I'm left-handed. I'm not good at pulling the punch. And I said, you're not going to hurt me. Come on. You're not going to. So we set up for the shot and she let it fly and she knocked me out.
What?
She knocked me out. I was out and I was on the floor. That was a real, I fell. And that was real. That was real. That was no acting. When I went down, I was out for about maybe 3 seconds, 2 or 3 seconds. But when I was coming to, I knew what had happened and I kept the scene going and I made up something and then they used that. And then I stayed down a little too long and she was like, oh no, oh no. So I kept it going for like a week to get her back kind of thing. Cause she was going to get me. And I was like, I didn't do anything. And it was male. And I kept an ice bag. Every time I would see her, I'd have my assistant bring me like an ice bag so it would be ready. So all I got to do is do that. And act like for a week. And she, you know, but anyway, that was, I mean,
just that's crazy. So cool.
Yeah, she really knocked me out.
I mean, that is awesome.
Hey, she's the biggest star in the world and the nicest, sweetest thing, you know.
That is awesome. Man, okay. So who says that, you know, they get knocked out by Julie Roberts? Heck, you know.
Tell me about it.
Well, okay, and now one more. I do want to give a quick mention of this because he is somebody who I had a lot of respect for. One of my favorite football players of all time, and also being a Knoxville native, you did the movie with Reggie White, Reggie's Prayer.
Oh yeah,
and the Minister of Defense. I am a Green Bay Packers fan, by the way, and the reason why is I became a fan. You know, growing up in this area back in the day, we didn't have a pro team, so I followed Reggie when he went to Green Bay. When he left Philly, and went to Green Bay, and I've been a Pack fan ever since. But what was it like? What was Reggie White like?
Reggie was exactly like, he was bigger than life, but he was a big teddy bear. And on the football field, he would knock you out and then help you pick you back up and say, God loves you. You know, and mean it, you know, he was very smart. He was a great husband to Sarah and a great father to those kids. They're not kids now. They're like, you know, 20s and 30s. But I learned a lot about having patience with being around him. And he had a way about him, you know, and I understand why, you know, everybody said I could imagine just playing ball with him, you know. So the cool thing about the movie we did called Reggie's Prayer was the story was he quits football at the height of his career to make a difference in just one kid's life. And we filmed that in Knoxville, but most of it in Portland. And then he goes on back. He decides once he's done that, he goes back to pro football and wins the Super Bowl. He literally went back and he won the Super Bowl. That year.
That's crazy. Isn't that crazy?
I mean, I was on the set. And then, I mean, just an incredible. And then, you know, Paul White, the giant, you know, Big Show, I guess they call him. Yeah. I'd never seen a man that big in my life. And, you know, he could play basketball like Shaq. He was like dribbling the ball behind his back, finger rolls, shooting jump shots. He's 7'4", 7'5", 500 pounds. And he was in his 20s then. He wasn't this big guy. He wasn't the big star. He was just starting. I saw him. I thought I was looking at a monster. And there's a picture of this, and I'll send you this picture. It's got his hand on my head, and I'm right at his waist kind of thing. And he's got his thumb is like big as my wrist because he couldn't get his finger around the gun in a scene. So they just laid the gun next to his hand. But anyway, he had to fight Reggie. I had never seen a man that big in my life. And we remained friends, though. He's a great guy.
That is so cool.
I asked him why he didn't play basketball. You're that good and you're that big. He goes, my heart. They wouldn't let me play. He said, wrestling, you can control how much effort and force you're using. He said, but basketball, he said, I'd run. 2 minutes and I'd have to come out of the game.
And, you know, basketball is like so much cardio. So
much.
Well, okay, like you are involved with the community, though, in Knoxville.
Very much.
Some things, you know, with some, you know, really, I saw something with Louis Gossett Jr. was involved with some of the other things that you were doing.
Me and Martin Luther King III, there's a couple of things. Cures for Hunger and Cures for Humanity, I'm president of, and I'm a co-founder. I was one of the founders with Eric Williams. He's in Los Angeles. And we have a system where water from condensation in the morning, you know, you can get so much water from the earth, and you put food inside a wheel, and you rotate it every hour, and the plants are upside down, sideways, and they grow three times. I mean, as much as big. It's just such a great program, Cures for Hunger and Cures for Humanity. And Martin Luther King III hadn't really endorsed anything. And I asked him, I said, why are you not? I mean, you're Martin Luther King Jr.'s son. What, you should have this. And he goes, well, I don't want to mess my father's legacy. I said, you can't do that. You can mess yours up, but you can't mess his up. Yeah. And I told him about Cures for Humanity and told him that everybody deserves pure water, clean water, and clean food, and safe houses that are affordable. So me and Eric developed that over the years. So that's going to be available coming pretty soon.
That is awesome, man.
And Keeping Dreams Alive is my foundation with Glenn Stout. And he's in Florida. And that's a foundation where we go into communities where a lot of people don't want to go. And we set these kids up with teaching them how to study, how to stay in school, and let them do the rest. You know, you just show them that you actually care, and you'll be there next year, not just a one-off. So I talked to some people that are grown now that we've worked with 12 years ago that said, thank you for staying on me. I graduated. I'm a doctor now, or I'm this or that. It's just wonderful to be a part of something like that, to see, you know, where, you know, I hate the word charity, but I just call it just you're giving your time, you know.
That is awesome, man. That is awesome. Well, I'll tell you what, let's do this. Oh, we got to do this here.
Oh, got my beer and my
here on the Abricot. Oh, what is this? Oh,
that's my new whiskey called Silk. I have a new beer called Country Roads with Rick Clark. It'll be coming out. We were at the bowl, at the Nashville Music City Bowl at the kickoff. It was called a Country Roads Kickoff.
Nice.
We won the sponsor.
I'm going to have to get me a bottle of that.
I'll get you. You let me know.
Awesome, dude. That is awesome.
It's made right here in Knoxville.
Nice. Well, I tell you what, this is the part of the podcast, Silk, where here on the Abracadabra podcast, we got to do a magic trick. All right.
Okay.
I'm going to try to do some.
Will I know what it is?
Well, absolutely. Well, here, hold on here. We're going to do this. I'm going to try to do some mind reading.
Oh, I love that.
Here we go. Now, this is how we got to do it, because we on the land of Zoom here. All right. Yep. Here we go. What I'm going to do, Silk, I'm going to hold these cards up to the camera. I want you to just think of one of these cards. Get a good look
at it. Wait a minute. Let me put on my bifocals.
There you go.
Okay. Think.
You got one in your mind.
I sure do.
All right. Keep it in there. Now here, hold on. Let's see here. I'm going to mix the cards in the deck. I tell you what, Silk, I'm going to cut the deck right here. I'm obligated. Okay. I'm obligated. I can't get out of this, guys. You guys listening to this, I cannot get out of it. I have cut the deck. Silk, let me ask you for the first time, what was the card you're only thinking of?
It was the Queen of Hearts.
The Queen of Hearts. Ladies and gentlemen, in podcast land, Abracadam listeners, I've cut to one card only. The Queen of Hearts.
That's tight. That's tight. Abracadam.
That is awesome, because I just did a magic trick for Silk Cozart, ladies and gentlemen. So
there
we go.
I was a part of it. Thank you. right, Danny.
Before let's do this too. Before we get out of here too, because this is a thought provoking question I'm going to throw at you here. And now, and I feel like this is very appropriate, very appropriate. And I ask a lot of people this question. And it's very appropriate with you, Silk. So let me ask you, if there was a conspiracy theory about Silk Cozart, what would it be?
It would be, is he an actor, athlete, or musician, or all the above?
A musician. Now, wait a minute. We know you got skills on the court. We know you got skills in front of the camera, but can you get down?
I didn't say how good a musician.
That is awesome, man. I can get down with that conspiracy. There we go. That's a conspiracy right there. I can get down with it. I tell you what. This, first of all, man, this has been great. This is, you know, a fantastic conversation.
I had a great time.
Now, Silk, before we get out of here, do you got any projects coming up? Anything coming out?
Yeah, well, I'm focusing more on directing these days because I'm here in Knoxville taking care of my mom. So I have my production company here. So I directed a movie called Inherit the Land. I don't know if you can see the shirt.
Yes.
And based on a book called Inherit the Land by Gene Stowe, and bought the rights to that so I could direct it. And it's a documentary about two ladies that lived in the Jim Crow era that, they basically were the wealthiest people in the state. And they raised a little black girl and her father. And when they died, they left them the most beautiful 800 acres in North Carolina. And there was a big trial about it.
Yes, so, I remember. Okay, I remember that story. And they wind up getting.
Yes. So
not to spoil anything, but, and you know, I remember talking about that story and my mind was blown. I was like, how come somebody hasn't done something with this story?
Right. Me too. That's what I thought too.
Oh my gosh. And so this movie, is it already out or are you?
No, we're negotiating right now. In fact, Regal premiered it for us. So now we're talking to all the distributors. So we just won Best Historical Documentary in it's called the Hollywood Weekly Film Festival in Beverly Hills.
Oh, man, I love that. So,
I have a sports movie that's getting ready to come out. So I have two films that I've directed. That one's called Inherit the Land, but the one about the history of basketball is called Ball of Confusion.
Oh, cool. See, you know what, man? First of all, now, you know what I'm going to have to do? And a lot of these listeners are going to do this too. I know they're going to be going back and looking at some of these old movies that Silk's in. and now we've got some movies to look forward to, some new stuff, some Silk Cozart projects. That is awesome, man. Now, Silk, if the listeners do want to learn more about you, any place they can go, website or anything like that? Or
Inherit the Land movie. .com. They can go there and it'll have a history of some things and about my new, and actually my new beer, Country Roads, we're getting ready to do some things with that. It's going to be out and across the country.
Oh, dude, that is awesome.
Pretty soon.
That
yeah.
Is super. I got
and I always tie, any money making project to Keeping Dreams Alive, my foundation. So we're able to fund things that normally we wouldn't be able to. So I always like using some of the money that we make in movies to go back into the community. And I think if everybody did a little bit of that, I mean, that's not like forcing anybody. It's not like paying tithe. You're not tithing. Like, you got to pay 10%. No, well, what if I got 20%? It's just that I think it's something that it makes me feel like I'm doing something instead of just, you know, making a living.
Absolutely, man. Absolutely.
And helping other people. I mean, there's nothing more important than helping children and older people or people that don't have a voice. That's right. I think that's what I'm here to do, is to inspire people and to help those that can't help themselves.
That is awesome, man.
In whatever way that God is allowing me to do that.
And I want to give you a shout out on something. I wasn't there, by the way, but thank you so much for agreeing to be a judge for the Knoxville Comedy Film Festival.
Oh, you're so welcome. What talent. Great talent. I was laughing my butt off the whole time. I was like, this is comedy horror sometimes, you know? I was like, I love it.
Me and my buddy, Chris Rogers, we had gotten together and we put the first one. Unfortunately, I wasn't there this year. I had a show. I had to go do a show. So I missed out the festival.
You were missed.
But you know what? Thank you so much for being a judge. And hey, also great. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast, Silk. This has been
amazing. Wow. You're a good one. You're a really good one. Thank you. And we'll do it again.
Absolutely.
All right. I know you guys had to enjoy that conversation with Silk Cozart. So many cool stories, man. So many cool stories. He literally knows everybody. And I'm going to be honest, an hour's not enough time with Silk. No, it's not. I mean, I have to have him back on because the guy is just, he's just got some awesome stories. He has done so much cool stuff. If you guys get a chance, definitely you want to check out his new movie that'll be coming out, Inherit the Land. And also, check out that whiskey. You definitely want to check out the Silk whiskey. You can give a Google and Silk pops up everywhere. He's a totally easy guy to find and one of the nicest, sweetest human beings you'll ever meet. Now, Abracadamets, if you have not done so, be sure to follow and subscribe to the Abracadam podcast on whatever platform it is that you listen to podcasts on. And like always, Abracadamets, thank you for listening.
Freaking miracle. There you go.